Good morning. Please be seated. The first case on the en banc calendars this morning is Ford Motor Company versus Trail, 67843. Justice Perry-Gary is recused on the case. We welcome Justice Stiglitz to the court and her participation in her first case as a justice on the Supreme Court. Counsel, ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Go ahead, Ms. Quill.
Good morning. Emily Quatto on behalf of defendant and appellant Ford Motor Company. This case can and should be resolved in Ford's favor on the causation issue because there was insufficient evidence roof crush occurred during the first roll to create the pinning scenario plaintiff's expert described, and the expert did not testify how the pinning could have happened over cumulative rolls. But even if there was sufficient evidence the roof was responsible for Mr. Trejo's death, the instruction the court gave on defect was incorrect. Not all products liability cases are the same. The consumer expectations test embodied in the current Nevada jury instructions was adopted in the context of manufacturing defects and design defects with res ipsa-like scenarios, where lay jurors can understand that the product malfunctioned or was surprisingly dangerous based on their familiarity with the product and its function. This crashworthiness case is different. Lay jurors do not know how much they can expect a roof to crush in a multiple rollover accident or how safe a roof can realistically be made. Courts all over the country and the restatement recognize that the consumer expectations test is ill-suited to cases like this one.
In this particular case, was there any type of proffer as to that proposed instruction, or was there any prior to trial motion practice as to the giving of this proposed test that you're offering?
Yes. Ford's proposed jury instructions set forth the third restatement risk-benefit instructions that Ford requested.
I understand it's a thirds, which is not necessarily has not necessarily been adopted in all states. And so I'm pointing back to Nevada. And this is a state court issue, and so I'm looking as to what was done to put this at issue for the court.
Well, Ford presented the instructions that it believed should be given, and it explained to the court that, you know, 36 jurisdictions around the country have adopted some form of risk versus benefit. And that would be consistent with the case law that Nevada has already put forward, cases like Robinson that are cited in our briefs, that recognize that the analysis that the third restatement embodies is embodied in many of the Nevada cases. It's just never been explicitly stated as how it should be given as a jury instruction.
Would this change the burden of proof in the trial?
No, but the court has options. So the burden of proof, I believe, should remain on the plaintiff to prove that the defect, that the vehicle was unreasonably dangerous, by showing that there was a reasonable alternative design when you consider the risk and benefit factors. There are jurisdictions, like California, for example, that leave the burden on the defendant to show risk versus benefit after the plaintiff has met her prima facie case of showing that the defect caused her injury. That's one route that the court could go, although I think the cleaner approach is to keep the burden with the plaintiff to show that the vehicle is unreasonably dangerous. And that's really no different than what plaintiffs are required to show and attempted to show in this case. The problem was the instruction that was given didn't task the jury with evaluating the evidence, even on the theory that she presented.
Was there a pretrial conference when the issue of jury instructions were discussed and the instructions were settled prior to the trial?
The instructions were settled, I believe, There was pretrial motion practice where this issue came up, and then the instructions that we were settled during trial. But the issue was discussed prior to trial. And in fact, plaintiff's complaint even identified risk versus benefit as a potential theory that would be involved here. So I don't think that there's any issue of unfair surprise.
Was there any time, did Ford file an extraordinary writ petition on the issue of this instruction prior to the trial?
No.
Okay.
So, 36
before you go forward, could you address an area that Justice Douglas was touching on? And that has to do with whether this test is viewed as a theory of liability or whether the test is viewed as a burden of proof. The Illinois Supreme Court seems to offer that approach. What's your view on that subject?
My view is that the theory of defect is unreasonable dangerousness, and I don't think it really matters whether it's viewed as a theory of liability or a test for defect, as long as it is embodied in a jury instruction so that the jury is instructed to consider those factors in evaluating the concept of unreasonable dangerousness. The Illinois Supreme Court, that was one way that Illinois went, but most jurisdictions just recognize that, you know, the theory of defect is there something wrong with the product? And the question is, how do you prove that? And you prove that by showing that there's a reasonable alternative design and that various factors such as technological feasibility, commercial feasibility, and consumer choice warrant adoption of that design. So as long as the jury is instructed to consider those factors, either as from an evidentiary perspective or as a theory of liability, the results should be the same, that we're testing unreasonable dangerousness by the factors that are relevant to risk versus benefit.
Well, if it's viewed as a burden of proof, why isn't it appropriate for the manufacturer to demonstrate in a product's case that there were no other reasonable alternatives? It seems like quite a burden to place on a plaintiff with respect to a case like this.
Well, the plaintiff would only be asked to show that there was an alternative to the product as it was designed that wouldn't have been defective. And that's really carrying the burden of proof to show there was something wrong with the product, rather than leaving it up to the manufacturer to defend that it made the safest possible product. But even if you want to shift the burden to the defendant, I think in this case, Ford would still be entitled to a new trial, because Ford's evidence would have met that burden to show that making the alternative design that plaintiff proposed was not reasonable. Because, you know, plaintiff's expert didn't test the alternative design in a variety of use modes that manufacturers are required to test. So if you add a lot of weight to the roof, as plaintiff's expert proposed, you have to test things such as fuel efficiency and whether that's more likely to make the vehicle unstable. And so the manufacturer ought to be entitled to present that evidence to the jury and have it considered, either as part of the plaintiff's burden or as part of the defendant's burden, as long as it's being considered. In fact, only the risk-benefit test really could properly guide the jury's analysis about whether there was something wrong with the product, because you have to compare the existing design to some alternative and then decide whether that alternative would have been safer and more reasonable to adopt. It's not just that we're suggesting that, you know, this is better for Ford or this is how it should be. It's really the only logical way to evaluate the question of defect in a case like this, because ordinary consumers don't have an understanding about how safe the roof can and should be made. And indeed, if risk-benefit balancing isn't used, really, and we follow the plaintiff's approach, which is just that Ford has to make the maximum safe product, all vehicles are going to have to be Sherman tanks, and no one wants that. We need to be able to balance the different considerations that go into designing a product.
Well, in this particular case, I wonder if this issue is appropriately addressed in a situation in which Ford had no weight test for the Excursion. Is that, is my understanding of the facts correct?
No.
I mean, you had weight ratios with respect to heavy vehicles.
Correct.
Weight ratios with respect to lighter vehicles, but the Excursion had none.
The Excursion didn't have a weight ratio. It had a weight target of 10,000 pounds, which is more than most other vehicles could withstand. Ford didn't apply the weight ratio to this vehicle because it's so heavy and because it often undergoes aftermarket transformations, which Ford can't test for and predict. So it's not that Ford had no standard for how strong this roof could be. This roof was very strong. It just wasn't as following the same pattern that Ford used for other lighter passenger cars and trucks.
Well,
and
is my understanding of the record correct that there was no strength-to-weight ratio for the Excursion?
There was no internal strength-to-weight ratio that was applied to the Excursion. I mean, it obviously has one. It wasn't the same that Ford used for other lighter vehicles. But ultimately, that really should be irrelevant in a strict products liability case. Ford's internal decision-making with respect to whether it was going to use one particular strength-to-weight ratio or whether Ford tested the vehicles plaintiffs proposed, those are negligence theories that really have nothing to do with whether the product itself was reasonably safe.
But isn't that the gravamen of the risk utility test to assess from a negligence viewpoint? I'm talking about theories now, but isn't that the underlying theory? We're going to look at a negligence theory now in a strict product liability case?
Well, there are negligence underpinnings, but the focus is still on the reasonableness of the product's design. And so looking to whether Ford should have built a vehicle with an alternative with a higher strength to weight ratio, the fact that it's possible to build stronger roofs would be relevant to whether, to one of the factors of whether it was technologically feasible to build an alternative design. But what matters is looking at the application of those particular factors to whether this product was built safely or not. And Ford would be able to present evidence under a risk-benefit approach that explains why taking an SUV like the Excursion and adding weight to the roof to give it the same strength-to-weight ratio as other vehicles.
But Counsel, I appreciate where you're going with that, but the evidence was adduced at trial that the Ford Excursion, at least the early one, the 2000 model, was based on a Super Duty truck, and not until I think it was 2002 or 2003 that they bothered to start testing Excursions, not Super Duty trucks.
Well,
So I appreciate what you're saying, and it sounds very good, but the reality is that, and the record is indicating, for the 2000 model, they did not test. They were basing it on truck design, and the truck design is very different than an SUV.
For purposes
and I think the common juror would explain that, which comes to my question. You're asking for this test, and you're talking about the complexity. Would you explain the interrelationship of the complexity and why it should be used or not used for the restatement third?
Sure. Because the consumer expectations test asks lay jurors to use their own subjective opinions and their familiarity with the product to know whether the product is unreasonably dangerous. When it comes to a complex product like an automobile roof system, jurors don't have an understanding about how safe the roof can be made and how much can be reasonably expected to deform in an accident.
Wouldn't an average person just expect the roof, a roof crash test, so to speak, just the roof is not going to collapse?
No, and that was not even plaintiff's theory. No one believes that you can just look at a car and expect the roof never to crash in a serious accident. Plaintiff's theory was that the roof crushed just a little too much for this particular accident. And this is exactly the problem with the consumer expectations test. Because when you look at a vehicle after the accident as a consumer and you think, well, sure, I don't want the vehicle to look like that after an accident, you're not considering the sorts of things that really matter as to safety of the vehicle. Whether or not the roof collapses and how much is really something that depends on complex safety considerations involving engineering and all sorts of other things related to consumer choice and technological feasibility. And so the manufacturer has to take all of those things into account. And so it's only fair that the standard for liability asks the jury to evaluate the same things that a manufacturer would evaluate in trying to design the roof. I don't think consumers have expectations about how much a roof is going to deform in a rollover accident, which happens less than 2% of the time. It's extremely rare. Most consumers never experience that sort of accident and wouldn't know what to expect. And what ends up happening is they just see the accident results, they see an injury, and say, yes, there's going to be liability. That collapses to absolute liability, which has never been the law.
We're eating into the time that you may have for rebuttal, but one last question, because at the beginning you started off with lack of proof. What didn't they not provide in the evidence, from your standpoint, that would require us to allow a new trial?
On the causation issue? They didn't show that there was sufficient roof crush during the first impact to actually break his neck in the way that they proposed that would defeat the common sense understanding and the understanding presented by Ford's experts that when you drop someone on their head, there's a serious risk of injury to the neck and head from gravity and rotational forces. They needed to explain how the roof actually could have broken his neck in the way they described based on the accident reconstruction, and they never did so. So I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
I'm going to add a couple of minutes to your rebuttal time, and we'll give Mr. Frederick 17 minutes.
May it please the court, David Frederick arguing on behalf of respondent and plaintiff Teresa Trejo. I want to begin this morning by addressing the relationship between strict liability, the present Nevada law, and what is being proposed and demanded by the manufacturers. And this goes to some of the points that were raised from the bench. Because the reality is, the risk utility test is not only unwise and wholly inconsistent with strict liability, it's unnecessary to add to Nevada law the kind of risk benefit analysis. The difference is, under Nevada law, it's not a balancing. Manufacturers are not allowed to trade off less safety for greater consumer utility and consumer choice. Why not? Because for 50 years, strict liability in tort has compensated as well as protected Nevada consumers. But it did so not on the basis whether manufacturers made a mistake or not, chose the wrong design amongst alternatives, which is what Ford now wants to make a demand. They did it because the manufacturer, rather than the injured consumer, is best able to both bear the damages and spread the damages that constitute a part of the real cost of the product. Now, what does Ford want? What do the manufacturers want that are supporting Ford? They want to say, first of all, no, the primary focus should not be on compensating and protecting consumers. It should be on striking a balance so that manufacturers can improve their marketability by trading off safety against consumer choice and utility. Worse than that, they say before an injured consumer can get compensation, they have to have made a wrong design choice. There has to be a reasonable and safer alternative, and the manufacturer has to reject it. Now, Justice Douglas, you were reaching for the idea, as well as Justice Hardesty, about the proof in this case. And Justice Hardesty was talking about the difference between proof, burden of proof, and theory of liability. The difference is between what Ford and the manufacturers want and the law we have now. The law we have now allows safer alternatives to be used as a method of proof, as demonstrating why the product is unreasonably dangerous. Ford wants to make it not a method of proof, but a requirement. And worse than that, Ford wants to make this requirement, the plaintiff must show that it is a reasonable, safer alternative as to consumers in general. It's not enough that it would make the product reasonably safe for the injured consumer who's trying to recover compensation in Ford's eyes. I don't know. The plaintiff has to come to court and has to prove that for the consuming public as a whole and in all conceivable circumstances, the overall safety of the vehicle is improved. Now, I mentioned before that you do not need this kind of trade-off, this kind of balance to put risk utility and risk-benefit analysis into Nevada jurisprudence. It's already there. And it's there by way of the Robinson versus GGC case, in which the manufacturer's requirement is very direct. Make the safest possible product that is technologically and commercially feasible. There already is a test which accommodates the manufacturer's legitimate interest in commercial feasibility of products. It's already there. And as part of that commercial and technological feasibility, the ability to present the evidence as to the risks on one side, as to the benefits on the other, and in particular the cost-benefit analysis of various safety measures, it's there. So that the trade-off that Ford and the manufacturers demand is simply not necessary a part of Nevada law, and what it would do would be to shift the focus of products liability law in Nevada from consumer protection to the balancing of safety.
Mr. Frederick, so in looking at the jury instructions, where among them, and in particular the definition in instruction 20, is the test addressed in Robinson found? One does not find in the jury instructions in this trial even the reference to commercial feasibility that is addressed in Robinson, as suggested by your argument. And if it's missing, then the question is, if our jurisprudence compels such an instruction, why isn't a new trial required in this case because of its absence?
Because it goes, that requirement goes to an issue that goes to the court, and that is the sufficiency of the evidence. See, the parameters that are established by that make the safest possible product that is technologically and commercially feasible, that doesn't answer the question the jury answers, which is whether the resulting product that ends up getting marketed is unreasonably dangerous or not. All that Robinson language does, and it's articulated in an appellate review context for that very reason, is it establishes what the plaintiff has to, the parameter, if you will, within which the plaintiff's proof must satisfy that parameter to get to the jury. It's not the decision the jury makes. The decision the jury makes is whether the product is reasonably safe, unreasonably dangerous. And those are the instructions, and have been the instructions, that for decades have been used to go to the jury for that very reason.
Well, but what do you do with not only the Robinson concept is not in these jury instructions, but neither is the McCourt versus JCPenney concept that alternative design is one factor for the jury to consider when evaluating whether a product is unreasonably dangerous. I mean, there's a sense here that this is this dramatic contest between the second and third restatements, but measured against existing Nevada law, did these instructions even satisfy Nevada law?
Yes.
As it stands now, which is primarily second restatement.
Here's the reason why. When you look at the instructions that have been used in products liability cases, neither that consider alternatives.
Okay, the Nevada cases. I mean, Robinson and JCPenney McCourt suggest inclusion of additional factors in giving content to unreasonably dangerous.
My response would be no more than the input varieties that may be considered by the jury on that issue. My view is that if you start identifying what portions of the evidence the jury should consider, if you start telling the jury to consider feasible alternatives, the McCourt decisions, the Robinson decision, What they do is they outline the parameters with which the evidence in any particular case is presented. And that's the reason why you have not seen, and believe me, the reasonable alternative design decisions go back decades. Nobody, including those who've revised jury instructions, has suggested that in order to make a proper set of strict liability jury instructions, you need to include those items. Because if the proof in a case includes reasonable alternative designs, the jury can consider it. We do have instructions that are used in some cases to talk about the jury considering all the evidence. But it's very dangerous, I would submit, and perhaps even unconstitutional, for the district court to start telling the jury by way of instructions particular items of evidence it's supposed to look at in deciding reasonableness. And that's why these factors which establish the proof parameters, what you have in order to make a case to the jury, whether you're a plaintiff or a defendant, are not part of the instructions. Now, in the time I'm remaining, I'd like to focus the court's attention on the jury instructions which were actually demanded below. Because not only is risk-utility balancing a bad idea in general, the instructions that Ford demanded and now wants a new trial on are a particularly extreme version of risk-utility balancing that quite literally hijacks the Nevada judicial system in the aid of marketability. The instructions have things in them like the usefulness of the product as compared to a safe design, the effect of liability for failure to adopt the alternative design on the range of consumer choice among products. Let's get real here. That means Ford wants to be able to tell the jury, oh, well, we realize this product could have been made safer, but we wanted to sell more Ford products, so we didn't do it. And that choice was reasonable. At the end of the day, what Ford wants is a situation in which the safety choices that are made by consumers based on the expectations they form with respect to product, and what nobody, including Ford and its amici, talk about is that those expectations are not the actual expectations of consumers, they're the expectations that consumers are entitled to have based upon the nature and intended function of the product, its appearance, and what the restatement second calls the ordinary knowledge in the community. And now we get down to the nitty-gritty. Ford wants a situation in which it can deliberately evoke consumer expectations, but have no responsibility for those. Here the language was reinforced roof pillars, safety cell construction. It was passed on to its marketing people, to its dealerships. Why would you do that? Why would the idea be given to promote those kind of features of the product? Elicit an expectation of something more than minimally adequate safety. But oh, no. Consumers don't know enough to use those kind of expectations that they have deliberately elicited as a basis for finding a product unreasonably dangerous. That's why courts across the country have maintained the consumer expectations test and incorporated risk utility analysis within it. It's exactly the kind of thing that Robinson commands here. There's no need to change the law. It's a bad idea to change the law. It transforms reasonableness of the product determinations into reasonableness of the manufacturer's decision-making process, and that is flat-out negligence. You would be regressing 50 years.
In this particular case, I asked a question as to their claim of insufficient evidence.
Right.
What is your response as that same question?
Sufficient. Succinctly, given the time I have left, the argument makes three major, basic, fundamental mistakes. The first one is cherry-picking testimony. They talk a lot about this discrepancy with respect to how much of the roof crash occurred on the first roll. Well, if you look at all of Dr. Paley's testimony, when he was confronted on Ford's cross-examination with the notice that that might not have happened, he said, well, in that case, the injury occurred to Raphael on the second roll. Second major mistake, denying the jury the ability to draw inferences from the direct and circumstantial evidence as a whole. Best example of that, they say there's no evidence of causation. Well, put together the evidence regarding the extreme bending that broke Raphael's neck with the evidence from his widow as to the extreme roof crush, i.e., the fact that the vehicle was flattened to the point where the window was gone on the passenger side, she couldn't even see him from that direction. The jury can certainly draw the inference, indeed it might be the only inference, that it was the roof crush that bent his neck and fractured. And the third major mistake, and this is the one that I think is the most telling, is Ford's continuous attempt to substitute expert opinions for evidence. Expert opinions are admissible to aid the jury in understanding the evidence. But there are three or four pages in appellant's opening brief that consist of nothing but touting expert testimony as if it established facts. For example, they say, well, you didn't satisfy your burden of proof because our experts tell us there is no relationship between roof strength and occupant injury. All the jury had to do was look at the direct and circumstantial evidence in this case to know those opinions were simply wrong. Ford's vehicle in this case not only didn't protect Raphael, it killed him. No form of risk utility balance can or should exonerate Ford from responsibility for that death.
Okay, counsel.
Thank you. Plaintiff's counsel says that risk utility is a bad idea, but I can give you a very simple, concrete example as to why it's necessary. Let's take the example of seatbelts. Ford could put a seatbelt, a 5-plate harness in a car that would protect somebody from diving into the ground in a rollover. It would be safer in a rollover. Rollovers constitute 2% of accidents. That seatbelt would be fatal in a front-end collision. Ford has to be able to look at the different design elements and be able to determine what safety features it can use because it will maximize reasonable safety for most consumers. Risk utility balancing is the only test that actually does what the manufacturer has to do in designing the vehicle. That makes the test fair, and it's fair to both sides. And also, plaintiff's counsel emphasized a lot about what Robinson and some of these other cases in Nevada allow the jury to consider. But the problem, as some of you recognize, is that the jury is not instructed on any of those factors. If alternative reasonable design is something that, reasonable alternative design is something that matters to plaintiff's burden of proof, or is at least something that can be considered, and in this case is basically the linchpin of plaintiff's case, the jury should be instructed to evaluate that evidence, rather than rely on consumer expectations, which doesn't direct the jury to consider any of those factors, and allows what happened here. Plaintiff's counsel getting up in closing argument and saying, if you didn't expect Mr. Trejo to be injured, your verdict should be for the plaintiff. That's not the law, it never has been the law, and we need juries to be instructed on the appropriate risk balancing factors, either as part of the consumer expectations test or in the pure risk utility test that Ford proposed. Jurisdictions throughout the country have done this differently, and if Nevada wants to fit risk utility within its existing jurisprudence, it easily can by saying consumer expectations, but defined by such factors as reasonable alternative design and commercial and technological feasibility, so that the jury looks at the evidence that was presented by both plaintiffs and Ford's experts and decides whether the vehicle was actually unreasonably dangerous or whether this was just a tragic accident. You know, I ask you just a simple question. When you get behind the wheel of the car, who do you want to have designed it? 12 nice people pulled off of the street, or a team of automotive engineers with decades of experience? If you want that vehicle to be designed by a team of automotive engineers, then the test should be risk-benefit and should allow the jury to evaluate what those experts do when they're designing their vehicle to make it safe for everyone.
We only have 8 people in Nevada.
Oh, 8. Sorry. And so, unless the panel has any further questions, I'll start.
I do have a couple. instruction 22, Ford's proposed instruction number 22, would have, at least in your view, I guess, addressed the explanation of the definition of alternative design for product in a design defect case, right?
Right.
What is it about the evidence in this case that requires a new trial, even if this court were to agree that instruction 22 should have been given instead of instruction number 20, which was given?
The reasonable alternative design instruction, I think, needs to have been given because the jury was not, with the instructions that were given, the jury was never permitted and encouraged to consider reasonable alternative design. And Ford presented volumes of evidence from our experts as to why plaintiff's alternative design was not appropriate. And they would have presented even more if it was going to go to the jury onto that theory. And so knowing that the jury is going to be evaluating the reasonableness of alternative designs, I think a new trial is required. And in addition, the jury wasn't asked to evaluate whether plaintiff's expert actually tested the alternative design in a variety of ways for which manufacturers need to test. And as I mentioned previously, you know, the jury was never asked to consider whether, you know, just because the roof would have been stronger, would that have actually made the vehicle less safe? And Ford should have the opportunity to have the jury answer that question.
One final point. When the judge rejected your proposed instruction 22 or the other two or three here, did Ford make an offer of proof with respect to this matter?
I can't recall.
Didn't see that.
Yeah, I don't think they presented additional evidence, but I think it was confusing because at the time, I believe negligence was still potentially in the case, and so the evidence would have expected to come in on the negligence theory.
So the evidence was essentially in front of the jury in any event.
Ford's evidence was in front of the jury, although I believe Ford could have presented more knowing that it would have been a risk-benefit.
Well, how do we know that without an offer of proof?
Well, I think if you look at plaintiff's expert testimony, it hints at, you know, the expert...
How does this court know there would have been more presented by... I'm sure Ford would have found more books and stuff to present, but how do we know that?
I'd have to look at the expert reports to see if there was additional in there that wasn't presented. But I see your point. But plaintiff's expert also, you know, we know what his testimony was, and his testimony wouldn't have satisfied the reasonable alternative requirement. So that in
but you argued that. You argued that in closing, didn't you?
We did, but because the jury was instructed to look at only what consumers expect and they were told by plaintiff's counsel that that's all that mattered, the jury was never tasked with evaluating.
But you argued alternative design in closing.
Yes. I mean, yes.
All right. Thank you. Any questions from my colleagues? All right. Thank you very much. The matter will